Right, we're in transmission number 11 of this series now. And in this we had a gimmick, which was that there was going to be a question which had a squirrel in the answer, and that was what everyone was supposedly looking out for. And the question that eventually turns out to have the squirrel is one about Cinderella's slippers. The question is, what were Cinderella's slippers made of? And Clive Anderson says, I know this, it's a mistranslation of the French for fur, ver, like a glass, but it's the French for fur, and those are the slippers you shuffle around in. The point here is, although this isn't entirely straightforward, Stephen says you're absolutely right, but actually what he says is wrong. It's not a mistranslation,
no,
because it's quite clear in the French version that was used for the English translation that the word is glass. It's clearly a glass slipper French version.
The more interesting thing, is it not, is what Perrault himself was wanting to do.
Did
Perrault himself, now just to say that Perrault is the guy who wrote the familiar version of the story in the 17th century, and it seems clear to us that it wasn't a mistake, but that he in fact did put there, he wanted glass slippers. But I suppose the point of it is really is that they may well have been in the original version, insofar as there is ever an original version of a story. This story goes back to, you know, there's a Chinese version that goes back to the 9th century, and there are about 340 other versions of it.
Yes.
So none of those are glass slippers mentioned. The original Chinese story, they're made of gold thread, and in the Scottish version, it's called Rashi Coat, they're made of rushes. And in the medieval French tale that Perrault adapts, they are slippers of squirrel's fur. That's the thing.
Okay, so in his source, it was squirrel's fur.
I think what's confusing is that what we seem to be saying is that that there was a mistranslation, you know, of Perrault's version. There's no mistranslation of Perrault. Perrault meant for her to have glass slippers, and it's, I think, arguable that that's a rather brilliant
innovation
in the story. It's certainly the one bit of Cinderella that everybody remembers. And he also, it's fair to say, he in all kinds of ways, he gussied up the story. So he took out the really grotesque bits of the medieval legend where the ugly sisters are sawing their toes off in order to fit the slippers on.
There's a version here from ancient Egypt, where it's the god Horus that sends out a decree that all the maidens in Egypt must try on a slipper, and the owner of the slipper would be his queen. So it's clearly, that idea is a very old one. I suppose has to do with the slippers have all sorts of associations.
Freud, of course, said they
Let's not even go
they're
there.
They're a symbol for the female genitals flash, of course, and I often think that of an evening as I slip them on in front of the fire with a pipe and a copy of Pliny's Natural History. The thing that's interesting, though, is whether there is, because it's the original, or one of the original versions is Chinese, whether there's a sort of a foot-binding kind of element.
A fetish issue going on, yes.
Yeah, sure there is.
So, John, we talk about phobias a bit at the top of the show, and one of the phobias is the fear of clowns, which is, what's that, coulrophobia?
Coulrophobia. I mean, phobias are a bit like collective nouns, aren't they? They tend to exist in lists of phobias. And
yes, they may have jokes more than anything.
I mean, I particularly liked, I looked up coulrophobia, and I found that the symptoms of coulrophobia are shortness of breath, rapid breathing, irregular heartbeat, sweating, nausea, and overall feelings of dread, although everyone experiences clown fear in their own way and may have different symptoms. And they're all swizzes, these phobia sites, or most of them are anyway, because if you look up squirrel phobia, which I think we invented for the show, which is called sciurophobia, you put that in, you get exactly the same symptoms. So right. it's. I don't think there's anything. I mean, I'm not one of the people who finds clowns particularly creepy, but some people really, really. I mean, it is a genuine sort of anxiety. I think they bring on some odd kind of psychosomatic reaction in some people. There's a website, www.ihateclowns.com's mission statement that says, there are people in this world who dress up and act like clowns. I don't like these people. I'm not clownophobic, or to be politically scientifically correct, coulrophobic. I do not fear clowns. Really, I don't. They're just not nice people. They scare little kids. They cause neurosis in some adults. They have big floppy feet. They try to fit too many of their own kind into a car. I could go on and on.
Are phobias always fears? I know that's the etymology of it. Mm. But if you think of xenophobia, I suppose you could arguably say that fear and dislike or distaste might be linked, but that's only arguable and it's not self-evident. But xenophobia is clearly used, whatever its etymology, in a way that means simply dislike of foreigners. Is this a scientific matter at all, or is it simply...
irrational fears, rather than just plain fear, which is supposed to be normal. I think there's supposed to be a degree of irrationality about the fear, isn't it? It's almost something that's you're compelled to... I mean, they say this about arachnophobia, that you have to, don't you, that you have to learn it. And there are very few fears that you don't learn. So it's some sort of psychological trauma in your... buried in the depths of your childhood. Yes. But, I mean, some of them are great. I like the idea of epistemophobia. Fear of knowledge is something that I'm sure many people... I like allodoxophobia, fear of opinions, something that I hope none of us really suffer from. Fear of flutes is good.
Flutes, the musical instrument.
Yes.
Teleophobia. fear of definite plans.
Something I definitely suffer from.
We all know people like that.
And hedonophobia, fear of feeling pleasure. And we all know people like that too. Anyway, I think it's all a bit silly, actually.
Nikola Tesla had a fear of hair, didn't he? Is that right?
Yes, and that's called trichinophobia, isn't it?
It would be.
I think that's quite a... that's quite a common one. I think the problem is that there are fear of stings. I mean, that seems to be a fairly... I don't really see that's particularly odd. Canidophobia.
Well, a fear of heights is rational as well, but I suppose it's when the fear of heights is... My father used to say that he had... what's it called? Fear of heights?
Vertigo. No, that's... I don't mean
vertigo. But anyway, he says that in him it took a form of... if he was standing near a cliff, he felt compelled to jump off.
To throw off. Well, we've all had dreams like that. If John were here, he'd say that is one of the two primal fears that we all dream, the fear of falling.
Yes.
But I think some of the rest of them are fear, amatophobia, fear of dust. It's all a bit silly, really.
Let's talk about Punch and Judy a little bit then.
Well, yeah, we have the Swazzles in this show, I think this show loosely came under the title Carnival. And the idea was that we wanted to make people talk in silly voices, which they did to some degree. But there's some great stuff about Punch and Judy. The idea that they were, there's a sort of ancient roots of it in Greek mass comedy and so forth. And there's lots of rather dull books written about, Mr. Punch. But I quite like the idea that there is this character who debunks everything and who's sort of obviously he is himself deformed, but has somebody said the inextinguishable Marina Warner, the inextinguishable vigor of every man against all comers.
But he's this funny old everyman because he's a he's a wife beater. Yeah. He's a I think he even kills the baby, doesn't he?
No, it's really really strange stuff, and I'm always fascinated by watching kids. They do love it. Thank you, exactly.
Where's the baby? Kill the baby.
and so on. There's a very nice story from down in Cornwall. If Bodmin is in Cornwall, I think it might even be in Devon. Is it?
Bodmin. I want to say Cornwall.
I think Cornwall too. Yeah. Anyway. Nobody's yet managed to ban a Punch and Judy, but Bodmin Town Council came very close when they upheld a complaint by the Bodmin Women's Rape and Sexual Abuse Centre, who claimed that children were laughing at a man, woman and child whose only interaction with each other is based on violence. So rather amusingly, the College of Punch and Judy Professors... Now, to become a professor, I seem to remember, don't you have to swallow your swazzle?
Yeah, you have to swallow
They then declared that henceforth the police constable in the show could be referred to as PC Bodmin on the basis that no one could be more PC than Bodmin, which is...
it's not a great joke.
It's not a great joke.
No.
But they had it coming, let's face it.
Okay, well, here's another thing that was in the original recording but didn't make it onto the screen. still quite an interesting animal, and I know you've been writing a lot about animals recently, John, is the sloth or sloth, would I say?
I'm really not sure about this. I tend to say sloth, but then I think if you're from Bradford, you'd probably say sloth.
Does the vice of laziness, does that word come from the animal or the other way around?
That's a very good question.
I think we got him, ladies and gents.
That's a very good question. Which came first, the sloth or the sloth?
Yeah, certainly one answer to that would be the sloth animal came first by quite a long way, because they originated 35 million years ago, it says, and amongst the earliest known mammals. And some of them were enormous. There's one called the Megatherium, which became extinct 11,000 years ago, was the size of an elephant.
Slow but big. The indolence, sluggishness, came first recorded in 1175, and the mammal not until 1613. There's an interesting. I particularly like in Spanish the idea that you get your final vowel wrong, and you're asking for a deck chair, which is peredosa in Spanish. You might end up with them looking puzzled, because if a peredoso is sloth,
we might get lucky and they don't look puzzled, but they actually bring you.
They actually produce.
But then you'd have to watch out, wouldn't you? Because there's a three-toed sloth two-toed sloth, and one of them is vicious, and the other one is a good pet.
Quite right. And they are the thing about them that is really extraordinary is that they are so slow moving. Well, you know this thing that there is no such. We have green birds. We obviously have green plants. We have lots of green creatures, but there are no green mammals. The nearest you get to a green mammal is the sloth. And the reason that they're green is that they move so slowly, and they can't be bothered grooming. So they actually grow algae on them. I'm not sure even if it's a symbiotic relationship, but the algae does. It does, and they are so slow. Everything about the sloth is so slow. Their digestive system is unbelievably slow. And it's so slow that they can actually starve to death on a full stomach, which seems like a bit of an evolutionary non-starter. But
how can that be?
Well, I guess they eat, and it takes them so long to digest the nutrients from the food. If they're absolutely starving to death, the nutrients take so long to run through there. They have a very complicated, many compartmentalized stomach. And when that's full, it accounts for a third of their weight. And they, you know, they're a bit like reptiles. They use the sun to warm up and move into the shade to cool down.
When it says that the three-toed sloth is not related to the two-toed sloth, is that right?
Yes.
You know about this? And
I'll give you the chapter and verse on the toes, because the sloths in question, the two-toed sloth is called the two-toed rather than the two-fingered, but two-toed and three-toed sloths have three toes on each foot, okay?
Okay.
Okay, the two-toed sloths are distinguished from the three-toed sloths by the fact that they have two fingers, okay, on each hand, whereas the three-toed have three. So what they should really be called is two-fingered and three-fingered sloths, and then it would be, there would be no...
Then we'd all understand where we stood.
Yeah. But they're not, they're just not, they come from completely separate...
Evolutionary lines. Really.
And as we know, one's mean and the other isn't so mean. And
can you eat them?
I think the people have eaten them, but I think their reputation is to be pretty hideous as food.
There wouldn't be much fun in going on a sloth hunt, would there? I mean, you wouldn't need a horse, for example.
Sort of low-hanging fruit of the animal world.
That's right. And you could farm them, perhaps.
You think? I mean, they're sort of have rather unpleasant habits. They have habitual sites at the base of trees, which they use as trysting places. So they sort of, like a lot of animals, they wipe their arses. They only go to the toilet once a week, many of them.
What do you mean, like a lot of animals, they wipe their arses?
They wipe their arses on things in order to, let's say, leave a kind of, you know, a little message. Here, I was here, I'm sexually fit, and I'm available, and, you know, perhaps we can meet here in a week's time.
Yeah, well, we all do that.
Yeah, obviously.
You'd have to have the soul of a, you know, a piece of wood not to do that.
It's saying here from my notes, interesting, they are hunted and eaten in many parts of South America. That's interesting, isn't it? And they live for about 12 years in the wild, but have known to live for 31 years in captivity.